Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
It is late May in the year 2012, and that means we are starting to rev our engines for yet another presidential election that is a mere 5 months away. There is no doubt that religious rhetoric will enter the campaign this year, as both major party candidates, Barack Obama for the Democrats and likely Mitt Romney for the Republicans, will attempt to appeal to the vast majority of Americans who consider themselves religious believers. This is a fairly predictable constant in U.S. national elections, considering that America is one of the most religiously active developed nations. However, one might also predict that given Mitt Romney's Mormon faith, people will voice concerns whether his spiritual convictions will condition his policies and administration should he win the election in November. Already, comparisons are being made to the presidential election of 1960, when serious thinkers wondered out loud whether John F. Kennedy, the first Catholic to become president, would take marching orders from the Vatican. Will Romney be guided and directed by the elders of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Salt Lake City? That question is being raised. Alongside the candidate's religious rhetoric and concern over Romney's Mormonism, we will invariably hear voices concerned about the mixing of religion and politics. After all, our nation was supposedly founded on the basis of separation of church and state, and many people believe that religion should have little role to play in our public discourse. These folks argue that anyone with religious conviction should leave those convictions at the door when they enter the building of public service. A society with pluralistic views of the world must defer to leaders who would lead from a position of secular neutrality. To think through the role that religion plays in our public life, and whether or not we should run our nation's business along the lines of secular principles, whatever that might mean, I'm pleased to be joined today by Professor Hunter Baker, an associate professor of political science and the associate dean of arts and sciences at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee. In addition to being the recipient of the 2011 Michael Novak Award conferred by the Acton Institute, Professor Baker is the author of The End of Secularism, which will form the basis of today's discussion. And check our website if you want to get linked to that book, because we post them there. Hunter, thanks for taking time to be on Research on Religion.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Regular listeners are going to know that I generally start my interviews with some background questions about my guests, but today I don't want to put the focus on you so much as I want to ask you about the cover of your book, The End of Secularism. Since this is coming over the airwaves, I need to describe it to listeners. It has a two-panel scheme with the top being entirely black and the bottom being a photo of what appears to be an upside-down city that is saturated in dark green, almost matching the black panel above it. In the middle of the cover, separating the title and your name, there is a great big red X. What's the deal with that cover? It seems to have this Blade Runner meets Mulder and Scully vibe on it. Did you design that cover or have anything to say in it?
No, I did not. The folks at Crossway designed that cover. I find that young people like it. Yeah. You know, it has kind of a, you said Blade Runner, I think about kind of the Dark Knight, you know, Gotham.
Oh, yeah.
Gotham in decline. And of course, the big red X, I guess to suggest a terminus, mm-hmm. the end of secularism. When they first showed it to me, I kind of liked it, but the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, this isn't really a book where I'm writing about this dark future or anything like that. I mean, if anything, I talk about a lot of history, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually tried to convince them to put some sort of a dramatic scene from the French Revolution on the cover. But that was a failure, as was my attempt to get them to change the title of the book.
Oh, so you didn't want the title to be The End of Secularism. What were you thinking?
Well, I had the suspicion that people would think I was predicting the end of secularism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd actually be happy to talk about that idea after we get through this. But I was actually, to me, I'm arguing for sort of the unsuitability of secularism as a solution, that I don't think that secularism really achieves what its proponents think that it achieves for a society. That's really the message of the book.
Okay. So in many ways, it has that Francis Fukuyama type of aura to it. When he wrote the book, The End of History, people thought he was predicting the end of history, but it was really a debate about two or three different worldviews of how we organize the world. And his conclusion in The End of History was that democratic capitalism was the only viable alternative around. Is that kind of what you're getting at there?
Yeah, I think that's about right.
Yeah, so no prediction. I'll ask you at the end of the podcast what you think the future of secularism is and where you think the world or our nation is heading in terms of this big debate over that. But I talked about in the introduction the upcoming presidential election, which is not going to be the focus of today's discussion. We might refer to it back and forth. Rather, I just wanted to use an event that everyone is familiar with, that's on everybody's mind right now, to start to frame the issue of religion's role or proper role in public life, which is what you mentioned is the big theme in your book. So let's go ahead and talk about that. But first, I want to know, what is secularism? Is this different than secularization, or what's the relationship between the two?
Yeah, I think that basically secularism I think it sort of grows out of secularization theory. Secularization is this attempt at a description of a social phenomenon in which people are losing their religion or privatizing it en masse. And, I suppose this is going to happen. The idea is because science is so impressive, it sort of overwhelms religious belief. Although I've never really understood that argument. I love science. I want more science. I want to know everything we can know. I hope we develop tremendous technologies, but it doesn't tell anybody whether or not they have a soul. It doesn't tell us why we ponder eternity or whether we have a creator who relates to us, whether we can have a relationship with a creator. It doesn't tell us how we should live as moral persons. It can tell me how many nutrients I should take in each day. It doesn't tell me how I should treat my fellow human beings. But so secularism kind of grows out of this idea of secularization. I think.
Well, let me pause you a minute there. And yeah. I want to get back to secularization theory, because you say secularism grows out of secularization. I want to explore that topic a little bit more.
Sure.
Here. One of the things you mentioned is that either people will lose their religion. This is what people think of in this extreme of secularization theory, that belief just vanishes because we learn that volcanoes are due to plate tectonics and magma coming up from the ground instead of volcanic nymphs and the hand of God, so to speak. But you also said something, that religion will be privatized. And that has always confused me, that phrase, privatizing religion. What does privatizing religion mean?
Well, I think it's that idea behind the old insight. People used to say that at a dinner party, you're never supposed to talk about politics or religion. The idea that to talk about religion in public is sort of out of place, that it's embarrassing, that, you know, maybe it's nice if you have a special kind of candle ceremony at your home or church, but that these sort of things should never be in the public square. And that it's really, you know, it's kind of cringeworthy when some athlete talks about Jesus Christ or something like that. Privatization means that it's, you know, it's this thing that sort of, you know, for you and people who are close to you, but not for you to share with others out in the community.
So essentially what has happened perhaps in the past is people were in the town square praying, but now you just need to go home and close the drapes and do this late at night when nobody can
exactly.
See or hear you. Okay. Tell us a little bit about secularization theory. Where does this secularization theory come from, and who are some of the main proponents of it, and what's it trying to say?
Well, I'm not a sociologist, but I think that secularization theory sort of grows out of I think Weber is part of it. I think that Durkheim is another part of it. You know, Durkheim sort of has this idea of religion as the society worshiping itself. And once you sort of penetrate that veil, then you sort of see the illusion, right? And religion loses its force. And with Weber, of course, you have this sort of notion of the independence of various activities of life from some sort of supervising kind of canopy of religion and morality, that the various activities of life have their own independent logic, and that they don't really need religion to be interfering with that. I think that's sort of where it begins, and it kind of is picked up on by a number of people who then sort of project that modernity and kind of our greater insight and the advancement of science and technology will lead us to outgrow religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, secularization theory had its heyday, I think, in the mid part of the 20th century. It definitely started before then into the 18th century, and one might even say some of the continental Enlightenment philosophers. But it's very persistent. I mean, even into the 1990s, I had colleagues coming up to me saying, well, it's really nice and cute that you study religion, but that's not going anywhere because nobody's going to go to church, and so you won't have a topic to study in a few years. And then 9/11 happened, and people said, whoa, there's a lot of Islamic fundamentalism around. What's this all about? And I tried pointing out to them that this has been all around for the past several hundred years. It hasn't gone away, only perhaps in the halls of academic theorizing.
Well, you know, I love the if you – I don't know if you've run across this, but Peter Berger, Peter Berger used to be a secularization theorist. Berger, back around 1970, told the New York Times that the new millennium, referring to the year 2000, would see only tiny groups of believers huddled together against the onslaught of modernity.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, obviously he's revised his views.
He did. I actually had the opportunity to meet with him in Istanbul, of all places. I got a picture of me with him, and I'm holding up a sign saying secularization theory is wrong, just to prove to my students that he actually has recanted. Because I said, can I take a picture of you holding the sign? He said, sure. And because people still read his book, The Sacred Canopy, which is a landmark book in the theory of secularization, and he's still selling lots and lots of copies of those books, but he's really backed away from that. So
yeah, that's right.
You know, I guess if you still sell books, that's pretty good.
But, you know, I want to say about The Sacred Canopy, I think that there is something that's right about that, in the sense that we no longer have the type of sacred canopy over the society that reinforces religious belief. You know, we have this tremendous pluralism. The mistake was to think that that would bring an end to religious belief. What's really happened is that all kinds of worldviews, religious and otherwise, are challenged all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very hard to feel reinforced in almost any belief because there are so many people arguing the opposite on almost any subject we could think of.
Yeah, the central thesis, for those who have not read The Sacred Canopy, in a nutshell, is with lots of pluralistic religions around, people are going to start to say, hey, is my religion any better than anybody else's? I'm Catholic, that person's Methodist, that person's Buddhist. You know, maybe I'm not right. In fact, maybe everybody is wrong. And so we retreat to a world of secularism. And I guess this brings me to that issue of secularism, that it's secularism kind of outgrows or is an outgrowth of secularization theory. So give me an explanation of a little bit what secularism is and how it might relate to the secularization theory.
Well, to me, secularization theory is supposed to be kind of purely descriptive, social scientific thinking. But actually, I think that somebody like Rodney Stark would say this. I think that secularization theory is almost the expression of a wish.
Mm-hmm.
And secularism is that wish that there could be a society where there is not some kind of religious supervision. And if you are a person who is not very religious, you know, who sees things a certain way, this is very attractive. I think that's part of the problem with secularism is that the people who see it as this very attractive thing, they sort of think they've threaded the needle and they've solved the problem of religious difference, but actually they've just accomplished a state of affairs that is favorable to themselves.
Does secularism have any tenets like a religion, a creed, or something that you have to follow, or is it just kind of an amorphous idea of we live in a world without religion, or that the public square is a religiously neutral place?
Well, I mean, in concept, I guess you could interpret it that way, but in reality, it just doesn't turn out that way. I mean, we may talk later about the idea of how selectively secularism can be applied, but I think that what you see is that if somebody makes religious arguments for protecting the environment, you know, young evangelicals talking about creation care, mm-hmm. or if they make religious arguments about welfare, social justice, those sorts of things, that goes over just fine. You know, there's no church state alerts, there's no fear of theocracy, it's very welcome. But then if you start making religiously inspired arguments about, say, abortion or bioethics, or maybe the nature of marriage, you know, suddenly the Inquisition has returned.
Mm-hmm. You do tell a really good tale of this at the end of your book with respect to a case that happened in Alabama. Could you go over that for us?
Sure. Some years ago, a law professor, Susan Pace Hamill, at the University of Alabama, she had a sabbatical coming, and she spent her sabbatical at Samford University's Beeson Divinity School, which is in Birmingham, Alabama. Her original plan was to write about executive compensation, and instead, she found herself writing about the Alabama tax code, and she came to the conviction that the Alabama tax code was positively anti-Christian, and she wrote a significant law review article about it, extensively mining the Old Testament and the New Testament to make her case. This was very well received, and she even convinced the Reaganite governor of the state, Bob Riley, to pursue the reform of the Alabama tax code through referendum, essentially to make it more progressive in nature. Now, at the same time she and Riley were pursuing this, this is right about the same time that Judge Roy Moore was trying to display the Ten Commandments in the Alabama Supreme Court. Now, Moore's action was totally symbolic, right? I mean, he just wants to have this monument in the lobby with the Ten Commandments. And he attracts, you know, this huge, huge opposition from all the usual sort of church-state separation groups. But Hamill is trying to re-engineer the Alabama tax code, and she is very explicitly making a religious case for doing so. To me, this is mainlining, the sort of super integration of church and state. And there was no opposition at all. The ACLU had nothing to say about it. People for the American Way, nothing to say about it. People for the separation of church and state, Americans for separation of church and state. No attention at all paid to what Susan Pace Hamill was doing, even though if you take in principle what she was doing, it was a much more serious threat than somebody displaying the Ten Commandments. And I think that just shows kind of the very selective outrage that secularists have.
Yeah, that it was a very interesting case, so to speak. Let me challenge you a little bit on that and play
sure.
the secularist advocate here for a moment. I would say if I looked at the Alabama tax code case with Riley and Hamill pressing this versus Roy Moore and the Ten Commandments. Roy Moore puts this big piece of rock in the middle of the courthouse. And every day that I have to walk by, if I'm a lawyer or if I'm a defendant or someone involved in a case, I have to look at that and be reminded that, hey, this is a Christian nation. And that makes me feel bad. It makes me feel out of place. It makes me feel like a second-class citizen. With the tax code, on the other hand, yeah, you might have religious justifications for implementing a progressive tax system, but you know, that's when that is all written into law, there's nothing that makes me feel like, well, this is not Christian. I'm not Christian, so I don't belong here to the nation. I'm just paying taxes. There's plenty of other justifications for a progressive tax system, and this was only one that was used. How would you respond to that?
Well, I'll tell you, I think the person who is really right about this is Stephen D. Smith, And he has kind of argued that in these church-state affairs, we need to look at sort of a real harm analysis. Okay, the Roy Moore example is purely symbolic. Very little is actually happening to you if you are the religious dissenter. You know, essentially nothing. Whereas, let's say that you are a very secular person, and you are a person who is better off, and you have these Christian moralizers tinkering with the tax code to the effect that you are going to pay thousands of dollars more in taxes every year. Where is the more severe harm? Who is going to feel more put upon? I would suggest to you that the person who's paying the taxes is going to feel a lot more put upon than the person who merely has to observe the existence of a monument for the Ten Commandments.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see where that is. But again, I'll press on this, is when I pay my taxes, it doesn't say religious tax code or tax code written because of Old Testament concerns on it. So, you know, when I get my tax bill, I don't know where it just says pay this and then you check off the box and send a check in. Whereas, again, with Roy Moore, you know, it might be symbolic. Some people might have a hugely symbolic attachment to their role as a citizen.
Well, let me challenge the challenge. When we talk about restricting abortion, mm-hmm. do the people who are so against that, who prefer more of a laissez-faire approach to abortion, do they feel better about it if somebody is able to make very secular arguments about restricting abortion?
Uh-huh.
They don't feel better.
Yeah.
They feel miserable, and they'll continue to insist on theocratic imposition. So, I mean, to me, really what's going on is that what feels bad, it's not the religious part that is the unique harm. What feels bad is that power is being used to do something that you disagree with. That's what feels bad. It's not the religious element that really makes it bad. And with regard to politics, that's just an essential part of the activity. It's probably a good argument for small government. Anytime the government acts, it's going to be imposing on people. And there are all kinds of objections to being imposed upon, religious being one of them. But I see no reason why that should be kind of the special case.
Now, it seems that right now we're linking secularism with a specific ideology. And secularism is usually presented as a way to remain neutral in the public square. Last week, we had Robert Nelson on our podcast talking about environmentalism as a religion. And again, environmentalism has been presented forth as, well, this is a scientific theory. We have certain knowledge about lakes and our air quality, and we present it here. But Nelson made the case that environmentalism oftentimes takes on a very strong religious element to it. Would you say that secularism does the same type of thing? Is secularism another religion in the pantheon of pluralistic religions we have here?
You know, I have resisted the way a lot of Christians kind of want to say, well, there's this thing called secular humanism that is a religion. I've resisted quite saying that. The way I look at it more, and I've been thinking about it this way for years, is kind of in terms of just a competing orthodoxies framework, and the competing orthodoxies are, they are religions, but they're also various ideologies. You know, things like Marxism, feminism, environmentalism. These things are all competing orthodoxies. And I think that kind of my general argument should be that we should sort of treat them all equally. They should all kind of have equal access in the public square.
Well, give me some examples. We already talked about Roy Moore as people becoming upset that you put a Ten Commandments on a monument in a public building. But are there other examples where secularism is getting the upper hand over, say, religious interest in the public square?
Well, I don't know that it is. I mean, you know, certainly if we want to talk about things like nativity scenes and Christmas trees and monuments, then sort of a secular understanding is prevailing. But in terms of the overall course of things, I think that the jig is kind of up. I think that the idea of secularism as the broad national compromise that will be suitable for all of us, is kind of finished. I think that people are beginning to sort of have, you know, for good or ill, a more tribal understanding kind of the public square and the different groups that are in it. And that secularists are one of those groups. You know, sometimes I kid around that Bill Maher's show on HBO is basically the 700 Club for Atheists. you know, the secularists are, you know, they're kind of secularist atheists. They're kind of having their Facebook moment, right? I mean, conservatives had theirs with Barry Goldwater and Rush Limbaugh and Ronald Reagan. They sort of realized their strength as a group. Evangelicals kind of did with Billy Graham and Chuck Colson. And now that's kind of happening for secularists. And on one hand, it feels good because they see that, wow, we can make something a bestseller or we can be the basis for the audience for a TV show or something like that. But at the same time, that sort of means, oh, you know, we can't be the foundation anymore. You know, we're more and more recognized as kind of a partisan group.
Well, you mentioned nativity scenes on city hall lawns or in public parks, and that's what I want you to kind of address that issue in terms of your framework here. That the argument that is usually given, and this argument always comes up the early December when everybody's decorating for Christmas, is that if you put up a nativity scene on the front hall of or front lawn of City Hall, that's an establishment of religion. Now, I don't agree with that argument because the government is not telling you you have to be Christian. But some people make this argument, oh, I feel pressured because the nativity scene says this is a Christian city and I'm not Christian, so I feel a little bit out of it. That argument comes up. But then the argument follows is that, you know, government should remain neutral in this. And, you know, don't put up a nativity scene, just leave it blank. You know, let the snow fall on the front lawn, shovel it off the sidewalks, and be done with it. I have a lot of friends who get very upset every year around that time by saying, hey, you know, it's an offense to me, it's an affront to my beliefs that we can't put a nativity scene on City Hall lawn. And me, on the other hand, you know, as I'm a practicing Christian, but I say, you know what, I don't want City Hall to put up a nativity scene. I want them to give me a permit so I can add on to my tool shed. What are your thoughts on how the government should be neutral? Is this a big issue or what?
Well, I'm not a person who is eager to try to strike those cultural blows. You know, I don't think that we should try to have the nativity scene on the courthouse steps and then feel very triumphant about that. But on the other hand, I would say that I think we should realize that culture is made of real history and traditions. That things like laws and culture, they don't consist of, you know, some bare minimum of free-floating agreement at any given time. Instead, there's some rootedness there. There's some durability there. And I think we should give some deference to that reality. I mean, sometimes I kid with students about this, that reacting to some of the Judeo-Christian resonances of American culture in an angry or negative way is kind of like going to Ireland, immigrating to Ireland and living there for a while, and then just kind of saying, oh, you know, I've just had it with all this Irish crap everywhere. You know what I mean? To some extent, I mean, I think there should be some deference to the fact that culture, you know, culture is kind of organic.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some things that are just sort of there. And again, I kind of point to Stephen D. Smith, who said, you know, let's look to the real harm and let's have some flexibility here. Let's not have like a super rigid principle. Instead, let's recognize that church and state matters could be a little bit different in Massachusetts than they are in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's right.
A more federalist kind of approach to it, to let the local communities decide.
Exactly.
They have. Yeah, I can understand that. You mentioned students. And here's another part of the book where you talked about secularism manifesting itself. It's the public education system. What can you say about that?
Well, I think that the public education system has always been intended to have an influence on students beyond simply educating themselves, beyond simply educating them. I think that that if you look back, I mean, at one point there's a very clear effort to use it to Protestantize students, to Americanize them, to kind of conform them to a particular American ideal. You know, even for me, being in school in the 1970s in Alabama as an elementary school student, we had some very clear kind of ideological, you know, we sang patriotic songs, you know, things like that. Maybe it was the Cold War. But now, probably partly due to increased influence from teachers' unions and for those who kind of have enthusiasm for government programs, I think that the public schools probably tend to inculcate a certain set of values. Certainly, I think that Michael McConnell had a good point about this. He kind of argued that by the mere exclusion of Christianity from the public schools, that it sends a certain message to the students that, you know, this is maybe something that your parents talk about and you hear about it on Sunday, but here, between 7:30 and 3:30, Christianity doesn't count for anything. That we're sending them a certain message.
Yeah, that, for me, that was a very tangible thing. I mean, I brought up the issue of the nativity scene on the city hall because for me, it's not a big deal. And I'm somewhat annoyed by that controversy every year, but you make a very good case about it in public school system. And this really illustrates the issue of, is secularism a really neutral playing field? Because people would argue that, hey, we can't talk about religion in public school. It's not just talking about prayer or, you know, having somebody lead a prayer, having a Catholic priest come in and, you know, everybody does Hail Mary and or prays the rosary and, you know, you move on with it. That could be seem pretty intense. But you're also describing things in your book, and as you mentioned, McConnell and others have said, religion is completely scoured out of it. There's no mention of the religious principles founding of the nation, of religious right. views of some of the founders and such. And that seems to get away from that neutral playing field, that it's tipped in the other direction, that, well, we not only do we not promote religion, but we don't even talk about it anymore. Is that what we're getting
yeah,
at?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. And I'll tell you, if I was writing the book now, I would also talk about John Stuart Mill. You know, John Stuart Mill is no great friend of the Christian faith, but one thing that was interesting is that he argued that the government should not be allowed to run schools, that the temptation to inculcate a particular opinion would be too strong. Mill thought that that instead, if government wanted to subsidize education, it could do so, but that schools should be purely privately run so that parents and students could sort of choose the schools of their choice.
And Mill sounds like he's the first proponent of the voucher system long before.
I know,
Mill
isn't that interesting? Or kind of like Dutch pillarization or something.
Yeah, and that's an issue that's come up too, how the Dutch have pillarized. It reminds me of Stephen Monsma and Chris Soper's book, The Challenge of Pluralism, where they're making similar arguments in terms of we really need to rethink the way that we introduce or at least level the playing field for religious groups, be it in the public square writ large or in education more specifically. Let me go ahead, and we're talking about the neutrality issue here, but you make a number of other arguments that secularists or people proposing secularism as a solution for how we run our society, why secularism is a better idea than others. And I want to go through some of those. One of those is that secularism prevents extremism. And this is always brought up, is that, well, all the wars in history have been created by religious differences. And if you look back in European history, the wars of religion are all about people trying to impose their views on others. Should we just kind of step back and say nobody can impose their views on others because that will make the social peace all the more likely to occur?
You know, I mean, I guess that's sort of what John Rawls tries to do with the idea that no comprehensive views can be brought forth. I don't know how he would classify secularism the way we experience it. I think he would probably say it's not a comprehensive view. But to me, secularism does not inoculate us against extremism. First of all, the French Revolution. French Revolution is very much a secularizing revolution, but it doesn't protect against extremism. It certainly is much less successful than the American Revolution, which is, you know, essentially is basically friendly. You know, the church is essentially part of it. The American Revolution is really just against the throne, whereas the French Revolution is against throne and altar. You know, strangle the last king with the guts of the last priest. in the French Revolution is the one that turns out badly. And of course, I think that a lot of the 20th century revolutions, particularly the Russian, can be kind of genetically tied back to the French. And again, there's no safety from extremism there, and ditto with the Chinese Revolution. Jay Budiszewski kind of makes the joke that, you submit to me 1,000 Frenchmen, I raise you 1,000,000 Chinese. The record is not that great for the secularists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can see how that is the case. And it doesn't seem like we have, by excluding people's religious values, we've tempered the debate that goes on, or even not necessarily warfare in the schools or warfare in the public square, but there's still certainly a big divisions of opinion that lead to a lot of conflict. I guess that's part of life.
Well, and let's not nurture resentment. I mean, if you look at John Locke's letter concerning toleration, he basically argues for this freedom of worship, freedom of expression. And part of that is that you don't want to drive people underground. You don't want to kind of cause them to nurture these private hurts and grievances lest they begin to plot privately against you. You want things to be out in the open.
Yeah, that actually makes a great deal of sense, too. Is it, well, let's get rid of one set of extremisms, but then again, it goes underground and can manifest itself elsewhere.
Right.
One of the other aspects that you talk about, too, that secularists always make is the debate about science versus religion. And this debate comes up quite frequently now. You got the so-called new atheist Richard Dawkins and a few others who are saying, well, religion really messes up the way that we run society because it's based upon misunderstandings about life or perhaps just faith rather than sitting down scientifically and reasoning through things. What would you say to a secularist who says we need to have a secular governing system because it's tied much more to scientific understanding of the world?
I think that that whole argument can kind of be undercut by one of the things that Dawkins says himself. He has said that essentially that Darwin's theory kind of makes sense of everything. It's kind of the key to understanding the world. And so he argues that so academically I am passionately Darwinian. He says, but politically I am equally passionately anti-Darwinian.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why? Why, right? I mean, if Darwinism really explains to us the world as it is, why not just embrace that, right? If you're strong, great, be strong, dominate, get rid of people who are weak. Why not? What basis do the secular leftists really have for arguing for the package of values that they often embrace? One person I think of is Richard Rorty, and he's very refreshing about it, actually. He kind of says, well, I just sort of accept that I'm a moral free rider on certain Christian traditions, and I'm okay with that. But they don't really have this. Science does not give you these full humane values by which to govern. I suspect that they think it does, but it doesn't.
What you said about Richard Rorty is very interesting. He says, I'm a moral free rider. I'm glad that Christianity created all these moral values that we have, and that's great. But, now I want to move it into the secular sphere. And I'm wondering to what extent that is actually possible. Or more precisely, could we have a secularism that generates its own moral principles? I'm wondering what a nation or a society would look like where, if we moved to a completely secularist society, we did push religion out of the public square, we privatized it entirely, where would we get our values from?
Yeah, I don't know what the foundations would be. I mean, I've been asked that question a number of times, and I think that it kind of makes me think about Elton Trueblood. And he had this kind of, he talked about the cut flower theory, the idea that, sort of our package of humane values and ideals, that it's like a flower that is planted in the rich soil. And, you cut the flower and you take it inside and you put it in a vase with water. And, it stays pretty for a while, right?
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately it decays because you've separated it from the soil. And the question is, if you sort of disconnect these values from the traditions and civilization that nurtured it, will they be able to continue to exist? Will they continue to inform the society? Or well, you just degenerate into a situation where you don't have a foundation, and really what controls is power.
Mm-hmm.
Chairman Mao said, Chairman Mao had a different golden rule than the Christian golden rule. His golden rule was, he who has the gold makes the rule.
And I
think that's what happens when you have no foundation.
Does it also lead to a moral relativism? Part of the argument for secularism or a secularist public square is that we don't want to impose anybody's values onto anybody else. But then if you're successful in doing that, is it just a free-for-all with everything? And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, Chairman Mao says, well, then it just comes to raw physical power, whoever can overpower anybody. But,
right.
I mean, are we experiencing some of this moral relativism because of our secularist notion? Have secularists ever thought about the implications of that?
You know, I suspect that that's kind of what you would think would happen. But the reality is that if you take the typical, you know, person who thinks of themselves as kind of a scientific, secular, leftist type person, they're not relativistic at all.
Huh.
Not at all. For instance, if I were to say to them, I think that gay marriage is wrong. In fact, I think that the acts committed by homosexuals are wrong. They would be, it'd be just revolting to them for me to say that. It would be very much as if I had said something that was against Christian dogma to a Christian. They aren't relativistic in any sense. They have a very clearly formed set of beliefs. It's very interesting. I remember the last names, Boyce and DeMaio. I think they're political scientists. They kind of did some studies on secularists as a demographic, and, you know, a pretty clear set of values emerges. They're not relativists. You know, they think some things are right and they think some things are wrong.
Yeah, we did have Luis Bolz on a previous podcast talking about anti-fundamentalism bias, and you mentioned that in your book as well. That is true, that the whole notion of a neutral public square based upon secularism as being a live-and-let-live society is really hard to achieve in practice. It's hard to let others live and let live when they start doing things that you don't necessarily like.
That's right.
Yeah.
We appeal to tolerance when we're in the minority.
Ah, yes. Yes. That's a good way of putting it. So let me prompt you a little bit in terms of this and think about what a society would look like without secularism. And so here's one vision of the world, secularism. We have a neutral public square. Please don't bring your Bibles or your Korans or anything else into the public square when you are out in public, engaging in public activities. That's one vision of the world. But you say that's not very viable because, one, it's not very neutral. Two, we send people underground and it doesn't necessarily alleviate extremism or conflict or warfare. And it's not necessarily all that better of a management system than just, say, relying on science or something, because we do have to figure out where our values are. But what does a world look like without secularism? How would you construct that world?
Yeah, I mean, to me, we already have a very good solution. And it's the American solution, rightly understood. We have the classical separation of church and state. One of our problems is that we misunderstand the difference between the separation of church and state and secularism. People think it's the same thing, and it's not. The classic separation of church and state is an institutional separation.
Mm-hmm.
Our pastors are not bureaucrats. The government is not compelling people to be part of the church. You know, to be born into the political community is not to be born into the church at the same time. That kind of pure, separate, you know, institutional separation. And yet, we understand that despite the fact that the church is separate, that it does not control the government, nor is it controlled by the government, that it still has a role,
mm-hmm.
Still a very active participant, even in the political life of the community. I think that's the correct way to understand it. And as far as, you know, well, what about as we become more and more pluralistic? Because, you know, obviously it's not just as simple as kind of the original American situation is lots of different Christian denominations, basically.
Primarily Protestant.
Right. And now it's much more complicated. And I think that basically we have a choice. We can either degenerate into kind of this low-level civil war all the time, or we can cultivate important public virtues, such as civility, charity, clarity. You know, we have to not be allergic to hearing what other people have to say. But the simple bar is really just persuasion. We don't need kind of these artificial language rules. We don't need to insist on people having a secular justification, whatever that means. We need to just, you know, let the market of ideas triumph.
So greater respect for religious liberty and freedom writ large.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can understand how that would be. Well, you just said something, and this is a little bit of a tangent to me, that people oftentimes confuse or conflate separation of church and state with secularism. And I remember several years ago at a conference, we had a European visitor who was giving a presentation, and he complained about the United States. As he says, here in the United States, you have no separation of church and state. Religion and politics is all over the place. I bring you Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson, right, who was running for president back in the 90s, in an example like this. You should be more like us Europeans, where we do have separation of church and state, and the religion and politics question is not a big deal. I challenged him right away, and I say, man, you got it just the exact opposite.
That's right.
In most of Europe, or large portions of Europe, you actually do not have the institutional separation of church and state. And it is not only harmful, I think, to the society, but it's harmful to religious organizations as well. And here we have that separation of church and state. And our dialogue is very dynamic. Yes, it can sometimes get extreme and shrill and uncivil at points in times, but it's balanced out by a lot of different voices that are in the mix. And so long as civility maintains itself, you know, religion and politics is fine, in part because churches are free to get involved and to get their parishioners involved and people to take their beliefs and bring them to the ballot box or to their campaign in whatever way they like. You tell a really interesting story about the Church of Sweden in your book, and how, yes, all of this idea of how do we manage the religious world plays out in some interesting ways. Tell us a little bit about the Church of Sweden.
Well, essentially what you have is in Sweden there has not been any separation of church and state, at least not until very recently with disestablishment. And even now with disestablishment, the government controls the church. But see, a lot of Christians think...
Wait, how does it... Even with disestablishment, explain that. Even with disestablishment, the government controls the church. How so?
The government controls who are the people who are kind of in control of the church, who are governing the congregations. The government kind of talks about the church as a folk church.
Mm-hmm.
And that the government kind of has and the people have a natural interest in the church, even if there's not like a real theological connection. And so they are able to essentially determine who can become pastors, who can have any position of influence. So the state is no longer fully supporting the church economically, but it is still in complete control of the Church of Sweden.
Yeah, you only need a small bit of control to exercise a wide degree of control. If you set the parameters,
right,
of who can participate, or even if you just help to collect church taxes, you know, the state might not be directly subsidizing the church, but you could say, hey, you have an opt-out system here like they do in Germany. You know, all of a sudden, the administrators of the church who say, well, you know, we need to buy new pews and we need to fund this pastoral activity or that pastoral activity, all of a sudden become very interested in making sure that their budgetary bailiwick is preserved in the next round of budget negotiations.
Yeah, that's right. The thing is that the Christian, the separation of church and state is good for the church,
mm-hmm,
because it maintains the church's independence and vitality. The,
yep,
the American churches are some of the most vital in the world.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I would argue that it's freedom enhancing for the overall society, because it's good to have this kind of strong, free institutional presence that can challenge the state.
Yeah.
That can call the state to righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, you have these churches that are sort of tamed.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of at the knee of the state. To me as a Christian, it's an unacceptable situation. I think that separation is something we should all be after.
Yeah, I feel the same way. In fact, I oftentimes make the argument with some of my colleagues and friends who say, oh, there's too much religion in politics nowadays. We need to separate church and state. I said, no, if you want to get religion out of politics, make the churches an agency of government like they do in Europe, because that will quickly silence them. And so you won't have to worry about anything in that respect. So they often they don't necessarily buy that argument.
You remind me of a great quote from Marx. You may have heard this one before, that the
Karl Marx or Groucho Marx?
Karl.
Oh,
Karl.
See, I thought I was more akin to Groucho Marx, but okay, go ahead.
That that the Church of England would rather forfeit 38 of its 39 articles than 1/39th of its income.
Yeah. Yeah, that is very true, I think, in many respects. And this is, in many ways, I get in debates, too, with some of my, strong evangelical friends who are, were very excited about the faith-based initiative when George Bush implemented back in the early part of the 21st century, and also coming out of Clinton's charitable choice thing. I said, well, no, this is not a good thing. They said, no, it's leveling the playing field. And I go, yeah, certain aspects of the faith-based initiative does help to level the playing field. But, I kind of like it when the odds are tipped a little bit against religion, because that forces religious groups to work a little bit harder to maintain their position in society. And that requires them to really engage their membership, to tend their flock more carefully, as one might say. So,
I agree with you.
Yeah. The other thing that we were talking about Europe too, and you mentioned this before, is that Dutch issue of pillarization. Describe what that is, and do you think that is a viable option for how to organize society?
Well, essentially, they have a situation where you take something like schools. They acknowledge the sort of religious differences that exist among people, and essentially institutionally provide for different arrangements, so that if you want to send your child through Christian schooling in the Netherlands, then the government will provide for you to be able to do so. And the same applies to other people similarly situated, but perhaps with a different faith or non-faith. And so that's sort of one way of dealing with pluralism. I think that's a healthy instinct. What I would rather do is to simply get rid of the idea of government schools altogether and simply allow the government to subsidize everyone to pursue the education that they want. I sort of follow Mill in that the government can kind of be responsible for quality assurance. Mm-hmm. And not based on some ideological test.
Yeah, I think that is a better solution. I know Monsman Soper, in their book, The Challenge of Pluralism, reviewed 5 or 6 different countries and the way they organize church-state relations and society. And they made very similar arguments about the United States, about secularism is – the system is tipped in the favor of secularism. But they seem to come down in favor of this idea of Dutch pillarization. And for me, I've been somewhat worried about that as well, because that Dutch system almost seems that early in your life, you have to pick one of the pillars you're going to belong to.
That's right.
And you get locked into that. And it doesn't allow for a lot of societal change and flux and the dynamism and synergy that I think we see here in the United States. So, even though the system might be tipped in a little bit in favor of secularism, or maybe a lot, again, I tell people in churches that talk to me about this who are very concerned either about the nativity scene on the lawn or what's happening in public schools, I said, hey, that's great. It's just going to make you work even harder at your faith, which, isn't necessarily a bad thing.
That's right. And the nativity scene, I have to say this, the nativity scene controversy is as nothing compared to something like the HHS mandate.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's really sort of a terrifying example of secularism at work.
You go ahead and discuss that a little bit.
Well, you have the Obama administration essentially requiring every employer to, including religious employers who have some very significant objections, to provide coverage for things like contraception, abortion, sterilization in their insurance. And that's sort of the the American tradition would be to accommodate, right? To provide some accommodation for In fact, this is what liberals used to do. They used to accommodate these kind of things, but instead just sort of demanding that everyone bow to this, I think, very secular objective with regard to the coverage. And that's really intrusive, and it has the potential to drive religious organizations underground.
Well, that controversy, and we talked with Philip Munoz a few weeks back about this, and we'll link to that podcast for those interested in it. That controversy is really awakening people to this issue that you're talking about, secularism, is how much the government trying to make a level playing field is actually not making a level playing field, that neutrality is not as neutral as one might think it would be. If you could, you know, from the perspective of the controversies that are going on and from the Catholic bishops awakening to the fact that, whoa, if we promote this healthcare mandate, it could come back to bite us, and so maybe we better rethink some of our previous positions. What do you see our political landscape now looking like? Is secularism firmly entrenched and that's the way it's going to be, or is there a challenge, a regrowing challenge to this, and you're going to see some changes in the future?
I think that it's going to be increasingly challenged. I think that, as I alluded to earlier, I think that it will be increasingly recognized as a very particularistic point of view that many people reject. You know, I don't think it's an accident, really, that something along these lines has been passed on in the form of an HHS regulation instead of being part of the bill as debated. Mm-hmm. You know, as while this thing was still subject to the democratic process, something like that would have been tremendously controversial.
Well, there was discussion early on in the process. I remember there was a group of about a dozen Democratic representatives headed by Bart Stupak, and everybody was saying, hey, we're kind of worried about mandates here. What about abortion mandates? And they went back and forth between the White House and Pelosi's office and says, okay, can we make sure that this is guaranteed? And everybody says, yeah, it's guaranteed. Those Bart Stupak and his crowd for the healthcare mandate, tipped the balance in favor of it. And then all of a sudden, as you mentioned, 2 years later, and we brought this up with Philip Munoz in his podcast, the mandate for contraception, sterilization, and abortifacient drugs wasn't in the bill. It just was one of these regulations that came about through the implementation of the bill through the Department of Health and Human Services.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's a very negative way to do it. And, you know, and honestly, I think that the religious liberty issue matters to the American people. I watched the, you know, almost all of the Republican debates because I often would write about them. And, you know, one of the things I noticed is that a lot of those debates were fairly dreary, but a lot of times they hit their stride talking about religious liberty, including Mitt Romney, who should be able to speak to it fairly well.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really important that in your book, The End of Secularism, I think you make a very strong case that the solution to this issue of secularism not creating a level playing field is really a good dose of religious liberty and the vigilance to protect that, because religious liberty is not just something we view in separation to all our other religious liberties. It is foundational to all those other liberties, including the right to free speech and the right to property and to do as we see fit.
That's exactly right. And it's just a recognition of the terrible situation you put someone in if you kind of put them on a collision course between God and Caesar. You know, you talk about impositions on people. The imposition of hearing a religious argument in the public square, well, it's a lot worse to be a you know, some people have characterized it a religiously encumbered person who is put on a collision course with the will of Caesar. We should try to avoid that situation if at all possible.
And that is a nice way to conclude this, but I'll ask you one more question. Are you pretty optimistic that we will avoid that collision in the future? Or do you see much more turmoil on this issue in, say, the next 10 years?
No, I think that ultimately we will opt for more religious liberty. I think that we're in the course of kind of working it out. Christians are conflicted. You know, Protestants first had to get over their antagonism toward Catholics. Mm-hmm. That kind of has happened through the pro-life movement. And ultimately, they will have to learn to respect the religious liberty of people like Muslims in the United States. And as we kind of cultivate those virtues, I think that religious liberty will be a winning argument.
Well, that seems like a great place to leave off here, a sense of optimism about the future. And so I want to thank Hunter Baker for being on Research on Religion with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.